First, I'm going to turn it over to the superintendent, Susan Castillo, and we also have Doug Cost, the assistant superintendent, and Pat Burke is not going to... Well, you know what? It's so much easier if I can just turn it over to you, Superintendent Castillo, because you know the program better than I do and know far more about these folks. So I'll just turn it over to you. Welcome. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, Chair Galizia, members of the committee. For the record, Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. Yes, so Doug Costi is back from the Office of Assessment and Information Services to complete his presentation about the work that happens in that part of the department. And then Dr. Pat Burke will be joining him to provide additional information and insights to the work of that office. And about 4 o'clock, Mr. Chair, I am due to be at another place, but my very capable staff will carry on and provide whatever information that you need. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Galizio, members of the committee, again, for your record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent, Assessment and Information Services. I'd like to start today by summarizing the story of Joey, and I'm reminded by my friends here on either side that I called him Johnny at the end. what I wanted to do is just wrap it up by saying that the story kind of pulls together the policy option packages and the work we're doing as an enterprise. And I want everybody to understand that this work has been well vetted by stakeholders. Every step of the way where possible, we are trying to get input from the stakeholders. This is not an ODE initiative. This is something that we have gone arm in arm with our partners in ESDs, school districts, as well as the university systems and community colleges. So that it's not something that we, again, designed in a vacuum. And we truly believe that that this makes sense from both a business perspective, budget perspective, and a policy perspective. So with that, with your consideration, I'd like to move forward, go through the POPs, and then answer questions at the end, if that's okay with you.
Great.
So I'm going to hit on each of the POPs I talked earlier about. Kids Phase 3 is, again, it's the technical infrastructure to pull all of the data warehouses together in the state and to provide data warehouses for all children of the state, not just those that are fortunate enough to have data warehouse capacity. So this policy option package is an investment of about $8.4 million. It represents about 9 FTE in my staff, which equates to about $1.2 million. It equates to about $2.4 million in resources, specifically business, and we refer to them as business intelligence tools. Those are data warehousing or data mining tools that allow schools and districts to be able to go into these complex warehouses, mine the data for research and analysis perspective purposes. These tools are purchased with an enterprise license so that all schools and districts will have access to these tools. It also provides hardware, and the big chunk of the funding for this policy option package is to provide the wiring to connect the regional warehouses with the kids' warehouse and to provide the tools, i.e. reports to the public, reports to the federal government, and standardized reports to the state agencies back, as well as reports to the taxpayers. So much like we did with the database initiative project, it provides a reporting mechanism back so that everybody can see data. The public wouldn't have access to the student level data, but that's the foundation from which the reports are published. The performance measures specific to this initiative are a little different in my area. I've taken an approach where we've applied performance measures to determine how this initiative is working. So you can see number 21, we are projecting in 2007-2009 that 100% of those student information systems will be connected to a data warehouse in some format. Number 22 is 100% of all students will have access, will have data accessible through these data warehouses, through these business intelligence tools. And number 24 is that the process for electronic notification and exchange of data will be fully in place during the 07 109 biennium. What that means is we will have the efficiencies generated by number 25, which indicate that we can move student records within 48 hours, business hours, of receipt, acknowledgement, and acceptance of those business record transfers. The other thing that's, and what that does is that saves about 10,000 FTE hours based on about 20,000 student records being transferred in any given year. What that doesn't include as an efficiency is the additional resources saved by district staff in microfiche and paper archival of these data records. If you go to Portland Public Schools, you'll find that there are literally warehouses of student records where these transcripts are kept, and they have to keep them for a number of years in order to comply with record retrieval and archival requirements. The next proposal is the assessment literacy proposal, and this is a, as I mentioned yesterday, the proposal to provide training in assessment literacy to school teachers and administrators. It's an important piece of the puzzle that needs to be filled. I believe the committee has in their handouts today an email we received from, I believe it was Forest Grove School District, indicating support for this. And the other piece that this does, in addition to providing standardized training and documentation and materials for teachers, is it is hooking us to the Oregon University system to continue this concept up at the departments of education within the universities to embed assessment literacy as part of the curriculum, for so that when college teachers graduate from college, they're fully prepared to deal with assessment data. And oh, I'm sorry, it was Reynolds School District, Robert Siegel, but you, I hope you have the email in front of you. The performance measure that this is addressing is specific to the SIP, which is what we, the Comprehensive Improvement Plan. So what we are proposing as a metric for 2007-09 is that for where assessment literacy is included as part of a district's Comprehensive Improvement Plan, we anticipate that student performance will increase by 2% where they've adopted this in a two-year period. In terms of efficiencies, the number you see there is based on potential savings on what costs might be incurred if individual districts were to try to do this on their own. The next policy option package is the growth model. And again, this policy option package is more of a reporting mechanism. It is intended to provide a better way of holding schools and districts accountable than the current status model that AYP falls under. It will utilize the full value of our assessment data by analyzing changes in individual student achievement over time. And it will establish an expected amount or an anticipated amount of improvement over time, creating what we refer to as a trajectory or a slope that we would expect to see students on in order to meet adequate yearly progress at some point in the future. The performance measure we are proposing for that is still under development, but one that we would propose is that each individual student would be given or assigned a target, a growth trajectory that would be acceptable to meet adequate yearly progress, so that schools and districts fully understand the amount of instruction necessary for those students to move forward. And again, the efficiencies relative to this policy option packages are based on what costs may be incurred by individual districts. The cross-office data management policy option package is an ODE package, and while it may not directly benefit schools and districts and students, indirectly it will. It will have a way, it's a way of better informing school administrators about what data anomalies there may be, and providing them, we would be able to provide better data analysis on data submissions by schools and districts. The target for
Mr. Castillo, Representative Morgan.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what the difference is then in between package 201 and package 173 as they relate to data skills?
Sure. The package 201, the assessment literacy, is primarily training for schools and districts specific to assessment data, the appropriate use of assessment data. So when when student data are returned to schools and districts, they get a huge amount of data. There are literally, for every child, about 100 data points that schools and districts have to sift through relative to scores at each individual student level, up to 3 opportunities kids are given in 3 different subject areas. So all of those scores are dumped on a district typically. Districts are required to then sift those data into appropriate ways and make use of them, put them in a form that school teachers can make use of them. What the assessment literacy project proposal is for is focusing just on those assessment data, irrespective of all the program data that we collect and report on, but just student scores. So in math, for example, in the different domains of math, there's about 5 or 6 domains that we report on. If a student takes a test and gets results back in those 5 areas and then receives 3 tests, that teacher has to look at those data, determine, is their instruction appropriately covering those content areas, those domain areas? And if not, what can they do about that? And how do they not make a misjudgment about those data? For example, number reasoning or geometry or statistics. We measure those different areas. And when we measure at a statewide assessment level, we kind of skim it pretty high level because we're doing it for the purpose of accountability of a school or a district, not an individual child, even though the individual child is taking the data. So we don't want them to make bad judgment about those data about an individual kid. They need to be able to learn more about that child. Those data that we return to the school or district are important to the school or district, but there's more information we need to know about. If you aggregate that data into a classroom level, it becomes even more valuable for a school teacher to be able to look at it and say, how am I doing in statistics for my class? Either some of them are getting it or none of them are getting it. If none of them are getting it, then it really points to something they need to do in their curriculum. And I might have to ask Pat to step in here because he's got the educational background on this topic. Because he'd like to add some more.
But on a very high level then, am I correct in saying that 201 is more directed at how teachers can use information about individual students or small groups of students to improve learning? And 173 is more to do with the system itself, to the architecture of the system and teaching people how to use the system?
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, kind of. It's almost there. You were right on the assessment literacy component, but relative to the cross-office data management, it's not how to use the system, but it's our analysis of the data. And if we see anomalies in the data, primarily in the data they submit to us, we are better able to inform them, hey, you better look out for this. It looks like, for an example is, we had a school district around Eugene that submitted their student identifier file, and when we put that into a report, it came up with 90% of the children were black. Well, nobody caught that until the last minute. It's because we didn't have analysis, enough analytical skills at the department to be able to take a look at those odd anomalies that occur in the other types of data outside of assessment.
Thank you.
Okay. So the cross-office data management package, again, is for ODE purposes that I kind of demonstrated. And that the shift is, what we're really focusing on is, as you can see in the timely reports, we have about 200 reports currently that the department produces for federal, state, and public purposes. We have been late on many of those in many, many situations, and what we're proposing is setting a target for 07-09 that 90% of our 200 data reports, not data collections, but the reports are done on time. We we are in the process of collecting the metrics this year and should have a report by this fall in terms of establishing a baseline. The
Mr. Costi, pardon me.
Yes, sir.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Costi, in my private life, I am the founder and CEO of a market research-based consulting firm and have the privilege of working with some of the world's top high-tech companies. I have some appreciation for the enormity of the challenge before you in pulling together all the data. I'm just curious what project milestone checks or assessments you plan to conduct to ensure you don't get lost down some rabbit hole.
Yep. Fair question, Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards. We are developing the metrics as we speak, but primarily it's how many collections, what collections are they, what's the anticipated date of release of a collection, is it done on time, how many days late was that collection, and from a reporting perspective, when did we say the report was going to be due, when was it actually published. So we have collected a very comprehensive matrix of all of our reports, what they're used for, what date they're supposed to be put out. We've established a calendar and who's responsible for doing that and the date. And if it misses the date, we make a log in this file and we are able to determine at what point, how many days late it was, and from there we can go back to the individual offices to make a determination of why it was late. Was it something we did on our side? Was it something that came from the feds or from the state? Or did we have additional work to do that we weren't aware of?
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you. Are you developing the software to facilitate this new data management system internally?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, no, we're not. This is just a simple little spreadsheet that we've collected. We discuss it on a management team basis. We put everybody on notice when these collections are due, when the reports are due. We've assigned data owners. It's part of our project management process. So there are no outside of Microsoft Project and Excel Project or Excel. Those are the type of tools we're using to do this type of work.
Mr. Chair, final question?
Sure.
Follow up. Thank you. Does that apply equally to the previous policy packages you covered, including the KIDS system?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe Representative Edwards is going to offer some pro bono software.
I'm thinking. I'm curious.
Yes. We've got legal data. I'm sorry.
Not sure if his is pro bono, though.
I know, but I didn't want to. Not in this environment.
During session.
Yeah, that's right. Talk to him in July 1st. Those are fine.
Okay, I'm going to get off of the cross-office one. That's so fun. And get into the Oregon Virtual School District. I've got two more to talk about here.
Okay, you know, I'm going to interrupt you.
Sure.
Because Senator Devlin's not here.
Okay.
And so I'm going to go down. Just before you move to that, I said that in jest. I was just kidding. If you were here yesterday. No. So here, this was my concern, and you don't have to sort of respond directly to it, but I think this also might. As I was driving home last night, sort of, what were we talking about yesterday, and concerns about the data collection and what we're doing, and we had sort of perhaps a philosophical discussion at some level. And I don't want to have that again, but I guess one of my concerns is, with all this data collection, et cetera, is, you know, we talk about local control in schools. We have No Child Left Behind. It comes from the federal level. We have state assessments. And when you talk about assessment literacy, and you said that, you know, it's a useful tool for teachers to use so that they can understand the data in a meaningful way, and then apply that information perhaps to their instruction,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense. What underlies my concern about this whole thing, and again, I think the Department of Education is doing a great job trying to deal with the world in which we live, is that it's kind of this banking model of education, and maybe Dr. Burke will talk about this a little bit later, right? It's sort of, teacher deposits in, opens up brain of student, deposits information into brain of student, and student sort of regurgitates out this information, because these exams, right, these assessments, all we hear about is content, right? So it's sort of, these are, you know, regurgitating lists of information. And is that, you know, to what extent is it measuring that? To what extent is it measuring just sort of content and not really capturing the necessity to think critically and to do analysis? I guess that's kind of my concern about this entire sort of model and the investment that we're making in it. And what you're saying makes sense at a particular level, but just as an educator, and I know it's not a policy committee, but still, you know, we're talking about these dollars here. I guess that is one of my concerns. And to what extent is there really local control? And if you are, I know there's a lot of people who say teaching to the test. I mean, that is significant. And if you have these content standards that are just lists of information, by the time the student gets to college, where they say, okay, I want you to, I give you a lot of latitude in college, and I need you to think critically and ask questions and not necessarily just fill out bubbled tests or computer tests. So, do you see what I'm saying? I don't know to what extent this assessment is actually really helping produce and create students who can analyze, think critically, discuss. That made sense,
Dr. Burke. I'd be happy, Chair Lisi, I'd be happy to talk about it. It sort of depends on how much time you have this afternoon.
Not very much. That's why I probably shouldn't have said it, but that's...
Because I understand your concern. I also would like to posit...
Oh, yeah, for the record, I'm sorry.
For the record, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the policy officer at the department. The most important thing that we do is teach kids, not administer tests. But good teaching has three basic components to it, in my opinion. If, and this is a big if we have said as a state and as a nation that we believe all children, not some children, should achieve to a high level, if we take that as a starting premise, that as a community, we are going to invest $6 billion in a system that believes at its core all children should achieve to a high standard. If those of us sitting in the room can believe that, can come together around that, then there are only three basic pieces that need to be in place. One is we've got to be real clear about what we expect kids to learn. Not just some kids, but all kids. So if we think it's important for all kids to have some understanding of algebra and geometry, for example, if we think it's important for all kids to have some understanding of life science and earth science, we need to say that. And that's what standards are. The second piece is we have to have instruction that actually delivers that to all kids, if the premise is that all kids need to learn to a high standard. So it's counterintuitive to say that we think all kids should understand algebra and geometry, and then we don't teach them that. So you look at your standards as a way of aligning your instructional program to make sure that students actually receive the instruction. And then the third basic piece is, how do we know they know it? And is that given to us in a way that helps us improve what we deliver to kids? And we know it by looking at what kids can do. And there are two basic ways of doing that. One is, what do teachers do in classrooms? And that, in terms of a buzz term, tends to be referred to as formative assessment. That is, that teachers are giving quizzes and tests and work assignments and things that happen on a day-to-day basis that inform the judgment of the teacher about whether or not the students are achieving the goals that we've set out. And then the state provides a summative assessment, an annual assessment, that looks at all kids across all schools in the state and says the schools in this particular district are performing at a certain level, the students are performing at a certain level, and we provide that information first and foremost to parents so that they understand what their kids are doing. Then we provide it to teachers and administrators at the local school level in a manner we hope, and we certainly try to very hard, to give them information that they can actually use to improve their instructional program. Then we provide information to school districts so that they can look at how their schools are doing and look at their policies in terms of that performance. And, of course, we have an obligation to you as the legislative body to report to you on how our schools are performing. And, of course, under federal law, we have a similar obligation. So, to me, it's not about tests. It is about quality instruction. And tests have a role to play, Mr. Chair, in that, but they are not first and foremost. Let me give you an example of what, if you walk into a classroom in Oregon and you see posted on the wall, and you see this a lot, a poster or a set of posters where the characteristics of effective writing that are drawn from state standards are posted on the wall. Some people would say, well, why is that? Well, part of the issue is to be clear with kids what the expectations are. That's not teaching to a test as much as it is making sure that kids understand that there are characteristics of good writing that all students should be working toward. So that when I give feedback to kids as a teacher, I'm giving them specific feedback on those characteristics and how they could improve. So like I said, we can talk about this all afternoon, but it's not about testing. It's about good instruction. And then a secondary use of the test is accountability. But first and foremost, this should be information that is used in classrooms to improve how we teach Oregon kids. Appreciate that. All right, Mr. Costi.
Okay. So to continue, policy option package 313 is for the Oregon Virtual School District, which was funded last year by the legislature. Currently, Oregon is providing course content for 31 high school subjects and is targeting expansion to 40 additional courses this year. We're supplying schools with video streaming, podcasting, online discussion groups, and we're providing e-portfolios, electronic portfolios for students. And we're about to launch professional development for teachers in terms of how they can integrate digital tools into their curriculum. And I want to remind folks that this is not technically a school district. This is a course offering and provides resources for schools and administrators to utilize. ODE has been fortunate that we have been linking up with private and public resources to make this happen. And I want to recognize that Oregon State University and the University of Oregon have been good partners in this endeavor. Intel has provided an application to provide a portal so that we have not had to buy that. Oregon State is housing that portal for us. And Microsoft is providing professional development systems for teachers through their donated system. What we put out on a performance measure for this one, as you can see, is number 10. We are going to see that more schools, more middle and high schools, offer advanced placement courses for their students, something that not every kid has an opportunity to have access to, and we believe that through the Oregon Virtual School District that we can improve the penetration of advanced placement for middle and high school students across the state. Policy option package 355 is the connectivity. Now we're getting into the geeky part of this policy option package. This is the network bandwidth, if you will, to ensure that all schools and districts have adequate bandwidth or internet connection, so they're not on dial-up or they're not on just DSL, but they've got a commercial capacity to move data through the internet. What this part of the policy option option package is about $600,000, and it is intended to work between the education service district portion of the internet and the last mile or to the school district. It does not improve any capacity within the classroom themselves, but it does open up the pipes for the schools and districts and give everybody access to a fair and reasonable amount of services. And then finally, the one-to-one computing initiative is a part of policy option package number 355. And what that is intending to do is build upon the pilots that we've seen in Oregon, specifically the Intel pilot where they donated 100 laptops. And we have four sixth grade classes now, each armed, every student and teacher are armed with laptops, and to expand that out so that more kids have an opportunity to have access to that. So it's specifically going to go to about 3,500 sixth graders, and that's about $1.8 million. And the performance measure specific to that one is to increase by 2% those students meeting or exceeding statewide academic performance standards for those kids that are assigned a laptop. With that, I hope that this presentation has helped pull together for you the comprehensive nature of my office, the work we've done with our stakeholders across the enterprise of education, and I'm available for questions.
Are there any advanced, on the virtual school district, are there any advanced courses, is there any subject matter that you don't offer online? Of the advanced?
Oh, yeah. Chair Galizio, we have a very limited offering right now of 31 courses, and they're primarily focused around advanced placement, AP-type courses. There's always room to improve and expand on those offerings.
Well, I guess my question is, is the department's belief that you could offer any course online, that you could reproduce presence, or that anything could be offered online? It's the same.
Chair Galizio, yeah. Anything we could offer on there, we'd be happy to. We have to deal with the proprietary nature of courses and be sure that we purchase those in compliance with state procurement laws. But it could be a place where we could share courses and curriculum. Individual teachers can develop their coursework and curriculum, and it's posted there for sharing for others to use. But I want to be clear that this courses that are offered aren't just given out to students to take. They need to be hooked up with an instructor of some type.
So I just have a couple more questions.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I just want to add one thing to Chair Galizio to Doug's answer. We are not in the business of trying to compete with other districts that also have online systems. Salem-Keizer, for example, has Salem-Keizer Online. Eugene Forgeri has an excellent program. The issue, or the gap that we're filling here is we're bringing online content primarily to students that don't have access to it in their home districts, and we can do it at a much lower cost in a more efficient manner, so that all kids in the state would have access to some of the things that some students in the state have access to now. Those courses, however, if we're going to do that, go through a screening process to make sure that they are consistent with Oregon State standards, and as Doug just pointed out, we're not throwing just any old content up on the internet. We're trying to make sure that those are quality courses, have good instructors behind them, so that when an Oregon student has access to those courses, they're getting a quality product. And that's the purpose of we call it a school district, and it's probably not the most accurate measure, but it's a way of making this type of content more accessible to kids.
Right. So, I guess my concern, I'd be really interested to see how you measure quality. Well, in this type of environment, you don't have to answer it right now.
Well, let me just quickly say that any course that we offer online as AP has to go through the AP, which is done by SAT it has to go through the College Board screening process to be called an AP course. The same is true as any course in a local school that's taught by a teacher. If that course is called an AP course, it has to go through an evaluation process by SAT. So our courses will go through that same evaluation.
So it's the same evaluation.
The same
criteria to evaluate an online course as a course where you have physical presence. The same criteria.
The term advanced placement is proprietary to SAT. And if you're going to call something an AP course, and as you know, we give grants to students to pay for the AP exams, and you've heard about that in earlier testimony, we can't do that with the permission of SAT unless these courses have been evaluated and approved by SAT. So we met with them about a month ago, and we will be submitting to them online course content, and they will take that same content through their evaluation process. If they don't approve it, we can't call it an AP course.
Yeah, I would just, and I'll turn it over to Senator Devlin. I think as a supplement, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I like having, you know, my online access, and there's a great amount of information available, and information is great and useful. But there's a reason why we're all here and we're not doing this online. And I guess I'm really concerned when you start to look, especially at younger kids. I think for adults, it makes sense. But I just think you have to be concerned. There's something about presence that you can't replicate, and it's very important. And so, and also just the way things are delivered online in terms of instruction, it's a whole different paradigm, to use an overused word, and I think it's something that we love technology in the United States, and we think it's always going to solve all our problems, but there are always unanticipated consequences. Television was supposed to be the brand new revolutionary tool to make education great. Oh, you could watch this screen and we'll learn so much. So I would just ask everyone in this building and beyond to just really think a lot about some of the unanticipated consequences and what is it about presence versus online instruction that's distinct before we sort of try to increase the numbers and all the courses and the you know, just sort of go down that road to the extent that we can.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I'm not trying to replace a teacher, but I understand the power of presence. Every one of our education service districts, for example, has two-way audio and two-way video capacity, and they frequently, to rural and small districts, offer advanced second language courses via that technology that the teacher is present and live with the students. And in the absence of that technology, those students would not have a second language program. In this particular case, we are not trying to replace, but if we have a student, particularly again in a rural or small district with a limited staff, and that student is interested in advanced physics, they have a way of getting to that content that they would not have within the resources of their local district. I agree with you 100% that the quality of a really good teacher to inspire and engage kids is not replaceable with a machine. That's one of the trade-offs in whether or not we want to provide an opportunity for students to pursue their interests when a school district does not have the capacity to offer that instruction.
Thanks. Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to get just a couple comments on the record and maybe get Mr. Burke's reaction. When we put this in place in the last legislative session, I think we had a couple of objectives. One was to provide this single portal so that people had more access, students, teachers had more access to online programs. The second objective was to actually give the superintendent of public instruction a greater role in actually defining what was an acceptable program and what criteria it would have to meet. And part of that is, I think there's always a misnomer when you talk about online. Certainly there are examples for instructional materials where you're talking about simply getting something online. But in most cases, you're talking still about a student having a relationship to a teacher. The teacher isn't really out of the picture. It might not be the most ideal environment to have the advanced physics teacher in Malheur County, but it is an opportunity actually to have the student to have that ability to have that contact. But the teacher is still very much part of the equation. And I think that's been part of our discussion in terms of what standards there should be for online programs. I think we were just trying to get a little bit, at least, close in policy to advancing technology and not ignoring advances in technology. Because I think my perception of online instruction was changed pretty rapidly. About 1 year before the last session, when I went to a presentation with Representative Flores, where I saw a lot of online programs that different schools had that were totally different from what my perception of online was. My perception of online was you sat at a computer and you pressed this button and you got the next page and you got the next page. And they had many programs in which they were doing some very remarkable things in terms of English as a second language, some very remarkable programs in terms of reaching out to rural areas of states, some states that are even, if you can imagine, more rural than Oregon. And so I think this is sort of just a careful maneuver into this area so that we can actually start to have more of a role without actually hindering the technology either, because just like in this building, when I came to this building, and I'll stop with this, you had a PC if you bought a PC or you paid for it. They didn't provide a PC to members. In fact, there were a few members that could not operate a PC. There are still a few members that could not operate a PC. Their staff are all... I almost got treated when I asked one of my staff when we were interviewing interns, did you find out if they were computer literate? And she said, is there a 19-year-old that is not? You know, so I mean, I think it's still in its infancy, but I don't think anyone ever approached this with any belief that you were somehow replacing a current classroom teacher. I just wanted to get that on the record.
And who's next? Representative Morgan?
Well, and again, just to reiterate that this is a tool in the toolbox, and that it is going to have applications that are fitting for more situations than other situations. And I know that looking at this issue from the perspective of a rural legislator, that this is a tool that my small local school districts can use to provide a diversity of offerings that the students wouldn't get otherwise. That we don't have enough people, enough students in a district that are interested in taking an advanced math class to justify hiring a teacher. And so we've tried different configurations of linking schools together with a teacher over VTEL, and that's got limitations, and that works in some situations. But being able to provide online classes is a real asset, especially in those small rural, small declining districts, or enrollment declining districts, where it doesn't appear in the foreseeable future that we're going to be able to take advantage of economies of scale. And this is a tool that allows you to take advantage of economies of scale without bringing people physically together. So I don't think that it ever will replace a teacher in a child's learning life, but I think that a teacher with online learning in the situations that I deal with is better than a teacher without online learning situations. So I look at it simply as another tool to use in applying education, in making education an accessible thing to students.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Representative Morgan, just to reinforce, Representative, what you just said. Part of the charge to all of us from the joint boards, from the governor, from the legislatures to make the system more efficient, and one of the ways that we're looking at is how the three sectors of K-12, community colleges, and the university system work together. Through the efforts of Senator Morris, I became aware of a project at Western Oregon University where the teaching of Mandarin, which many of you were aware of hearings held last week on this very topic, is becoming a priority for the state. So the obvious question is, who's going to teach Mandarin? Well, Western Oregon University has a partnership with Beaverton High School to teach Mandarin online, and because of the importance of being able to hear native speakers speak the language, they're using Chinese students who are taking their degree from Western Oregon University as part of the teaching force for the course. What we're embarking on here, I believe, and Representative Morgan said it very well, technology is dramatically changing our options in terms of how we deliver content, particularly in ways that students may not have had access to it before. The kids are leading the way. They are already exchanging gigabytes of information with each other. A lot of it happens to be music, but data file is a data file, and they are learning how to use that technology. I think the issue here is how do we manage new options? I remember in one of my first teaching assignments in 1966, my principal delivered to my classroom an overhead projector, and I had never seen one of those before. I had no idea what it was or how it worked or what I was going to do with it as a social studies teacher. And I think we're finally at a point where the presence of technology has become sufficiently user-friendly that we are beginning to think in very creative ways about how it expands our reach as instructors. Any other questions or comments?
I mean, I would just say, I mean, two things. Number one, I don't think I ever mentioned the word teacher. I think I was talking about students. And then secondly, I don't think delivering content is education. That's my concern. Representative Jensen, do you have...
Well, I was going to comment about overhead projectors in 1966.
I'm not sure I know how to use one.
And I realize I come from kind of a, you know, backwoods sort of country, a high country in Montana, but my teaching career goes back a little before 1966, and memory has it that we had overhead projectors. Although I would admit that... that part of one of the classes that was taught and sometimes referred to institution of higher education, the schools of education at the universities did include a 400-level course in the use of the technologies of that particular era, so one of which was overhead projectors. And I'd like, as long as we're, you know, just kind of philosophizing a little bit here, now I'd like to go back to make a quote from a name that will ring a bell for some of you. The children in the group will not have heard of the name before, but Dale Parnell, from a previous time occupying a position that I'm sure the Secretary is very well aware of. I think previously a president at Lane Community College, maybe it was one of the community colleges at any rate.
I think he was superintendent of the James School District.
Yes, maybe correct, such as that, yeah. But I recall in his statement, that they didn't have computers when he was making the statement, apparently, but talking about AV don't teach, libraries don't teach, school boards don't teach, Department of Education doesn't teach, teachers teach. And I think this and I disagreed frequently with Mr. Parnell, but I think on this one point I have always been in something of agreement with him. I don't know that there is a substitute for that. I do recognize and I do appreciate that technology can facilitate a teacher teaching. But this stupid thing isn't going to teach me anything. I may learn some things from it because of a teacher someplace that turned a button on as far as being curious and inquisitive, wanting to find answers to questions. But this is a bunch of silly keys, you know. It's not going to do anything for me. So, and Mr. Chair, I share very much your thoughts, and the reason I ask you the question that I passed across the desk here is my sharing your concern that this whole conglomeration of data that we store in a more efficiently than in this, in a memory bank here in the computer, is not my idea of what I want to come out of an educational system for my grandchildren. I want something to come out where it enables them to be thinking individuals. To, if you wish, be able to do the analysis, abstract analysis of maybe as yet unheard of questions. And just knowing a whole bunch of numbers, words, is not necessarily going to get them there. And I do have that. That concern about the testing or whatever it is we want to call it, assessments is a nice word for it. Testing is kind of the old-fashioned word for it, I guess. That doesn't get to what I think education really is all about. And I don't have a magic answer for that. I think maybe sitting at the feet of Socrates is the ideal. But nobody's willing to write the check to let us do that for all of the mankind that we're responsible for. And as a consequence, we use sometimes technology, and sometimes we abuse technology. And I do worry about the abuse of it, because it becomes in vogue. It becomes a thing. If you're not doing it, that causes me great concern. And I'm philosophizing too much about my theories of education, not enough about the budget.
That's right. Socrates has a website. So I'm checking my sundial, and we've spent a lot of time. So I don't want the superintendent to go away or Mr. Costa to go away and think that this means that, you know, these pops are...
Oh, why not?
No, I... but... any other comments or questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you.
Not philosophical.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a very specific comment. I would note that despite the most recent comment that the representative to my immediate right is the only one at the podium who is actually using the technology that wouldn't have been recognized in the late Middle Ages.
Chair Glazier, if I could respond just briefly to Representative Jensen, because I really agree with what he said, and I want to correct a misunderstanding. The state assessments are only a small part of this bigger question. So you're absolutely correct, Representative Jensen, that what kids do in classrooms with teachers and how they engage in products and activities and produce work in classrooms, that is absolutely one of the most important forms of whether or not a teacher is determining if a student is learning. So our assessment system is designed to ask questions that require a student to apply what they've learned. Our test questions are not just recall questions. They are questions where students are applying what they've learned. But in addition to that, the state writing assessment in particular is in fact a scored work sample. It's something that the student produces. It's not something that they do on a multiple choice test. And then in the area of English, mathematics, science, and social studies, they're doing additional work directly with their teacher. They're called classroom work samples. But they're class projects, if you will. They are assignments that are complex, that require considerable effort on the part of the student, and that the teacher looks at for evidence of proficiency. Now, that level of work, which in my opinion, I think you and I might agree on this, that's some of the most powerful type of assessment you can do. What's the student doing in my classroom? And it's that type of work that the state board has focused on the essential learning skills that they have now made part of the graduation requirements. We've never had that before. So writing for multiple purposes is one of those expectations. Being able to read from a variety of texts. So it's not just reading literature. It's also, can I read a science textbook with intelligence and understanding? Being able to apply mathematics concepts to complex problems, not just doing calculations, but can I solve mathematics problems? Those are the types of things that are now in part of the high school graduation requirement. And frankly, we have no intention of testing at the state level. The best work that you can look at to determine if a student is meeting those targets is what happens in our classrooms.
So next, I think we're going to, unless anyone has any other questions for Mr. Costi, thank you very much. You've been extraordinarily patient. Appreciate it. And I think now we're, I know the superintendent has to leave, so I think we're going to go to Sue McLaughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sue McLaughlin with the Office of Finance and Administration at the Oregon Department of Education. And in the interest of time, what I thought I'd do is just point out to you that you have received as one of your handouts the PowerPoint slides for my office. But I'm not going to go over those in detail because we have a fair amount of information yet to cover in the next 30 minutes. So what I'd like to do now is invite Morgan Allen up. And Morgan is the legislative liaison for the agency, and he will be talking to you about all the, well, I shouldn't say all because there are hundreds of bills, but some of the bills regarding education in the Department of Education that have been introduced this session.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and as Sue said, I serve as sort of the legislative liaison and coordinator for the department, not unlike your own legislative aides and assistants. That's essentially my role for the superintendent. And I work with the substantive education committees in the House and the Senate and education groups, education partners, to keep track of the many, many, many bills regarding education that are being considered this legislative session. As a matter of fact, our department is currently tracking about 250 education-related bills, and today we provided you with an updated Excel spreadsheet of the 77 bills that I'm tracking that have a budget or staffing impact on the Department of Education. So out of those 250, we're tracking about 77 right now. This update is updated from your notebook about 2 weeks ago when we put the notebooks together. We provided with you, and we had about 60 bills, so there have been quite a few more education bills introduced in that period. Just a couple general comments about this list. Collectively, they appropriate approximately $250 million in lottery and general funds to the Department of Education to expend on programs, studies, task forces, or to provide directly to various parts of our budget as grant and aid. I won't go through every single bill on the list in the interest of time, but I would mention I'd be happy anytime if you have questions about any specific bills that you see on the list to answer them. And I'll just quickly identify a few areas. Of the 77 bills on this list that we provided for you, approximately 10 bills require the department to staff and provide information for task forces related to education. None of those task force bills have appropriations to our department, so collectively, if we were to pass several of those, you know, one or two task forces might not be too much of a burden on the department, but if we start adding many task forces to our staff, we will obviously be expending many staff time and hours working with those groups. There are several bills. There's a package of bills to mandate the instruction of physical education through K through 8th grade, Senate Bills 367, 370, and 372. Collectively, those bills have an unfunded liability for the department of about $800,000 for the 2007-2009 biennium. They've passed out of Senator Walker's Substantive Education Committee, have made their way down to the Ways and Means process. There are two bills, Senate Bill 757 and House Bill 3334, that would establish a Board of Trustees for the Oregon School for the Deaf and essentially keep the department as the fiscal agent. That is, the money to operate the school would pass through our budget, but it would turn over the day-to-day operations of the School for the Deaf to a Board of Trustees appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and they would essentially assume the day-to-day operational control, including making staffing and budgetary decisions. There is a work group that Senator Walker has convened around Senate Bill 757 that will be meeting for the first time this Friday with all the stakeholders from the department and advocates from both the deaf and blind communities to look at this issue. And that will have an unknown financial impact on our department depending on what the result of that work group is and is if either of those pieces of legislation move forward this session. Another bill that has actually passed out of the Senate Education Committee is Senate Bill 46, which would appropriate $40 million in general funds to fund Oregon's pre-K program, our Head Start program. That's part of our budget, one of the policy option packages, and the governor and various legislators obviously have different ideas on how to fund that, but that has actually made it down to your substantive committee. Another bill that's making its way through the process that I think is of interest to folks is Senate Bill 318, which is the menu of options for local school districts related to the school improvement fund. That is what those districts could actually use that money that's included in House Bill 5021 for. Our department believes that would create about $170,000 in staff time hours for us to appropriate those grants and evaluate those grants. I mean, there's no money included in that bill to provide staff to our department. And then I know that the chair had a particular interest and wanted to find out about TAG programs, so I will just mention there are four major TAG bills on this list: House Bills 2533, 3037, 3310, and 622, which do various things, adding FTE or staff to our department or appropriating money to our department around talented and gifted programs. Most importantly, Senate Bill 622 recently passed out of Senator Walker's Senate Education Committee with an appropriation of $860,000 of general fund to fund staff at six regional talented and gifted centers. So I'll stop there in the interest of time and answer any specific questions you might have on bills on this list, and then that probably provides an appropriate segue, Chair Galizia, for Dr. Salamler to come up and talk to you about the talented and gifted programs and the work that the department's already doing, and I'll stay up here to answer any questions you might have about those TAG bills that are making their way through the process.
Are there any questions for Mr. Allen? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I don't gather there are very many, but could you highlight again the bills that relate specifically to the governor's recommended budget policy option packages? You mentioned the one that was the $40 million for the budget.
Yes, and I might turn to Mr. McGlash and help me, but...
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, actually the bill that pertains to the governor's recommended budget for our agency is the one that's before you today and on which we've been presenting House Bill 5019. So bills like House Bill 2024, which appropriates $40 million for Oregon pre-K to the Department of Education, is actually in addition to what's in the governor's budgets, governor's budget, and specifically the policy option package for $39 million.
have bills that are submitted at the request of the governor that are not in his budget.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I'm not sure who submitted House Bill 2024. I'd ask Morgan if he's aware of that. To my knowledge, though, it was not the governor. Everything that the governor had included in his budget for the Oregon Department of Education would be in 5019 for House Bill 5019 for our operations and grant and aid programs, and then 5020 and 5021 for the state school fund and the school improvement fund.
As a follow-up, I thought the Head Start was a part of the governor's program. It isn't that Senate Bill 46?
Chair Galizio and Senator Morse, just to provide a little more context, I'll let Sue handle the budget questions, but some of the bills like House Bill 2024 and I believe Senate Bill 46 were pre-session filed before the governor's recommended budget came out, so the advocates for Head Start or particular legislators that had interest in those programs submitted those bills before the governor's recommended budget came out and included that in House Bill 5019. So it's really a policy question as to whether or not this committee would want to add an additional $40 million in Senate Bill 46 to the governor's recommended budget when you guys are making your calculations.
Thank you, sir.
Sorry, Bill. Doesn't the governor's budget looks to increase in the corporate minimum for Head Start? Is that correct?
Yes.
Chair Galizia, that is my understanding.
Right. Representative Jensen?
Senate Bill 46 was at the request of the Senate Commission on Education Excellence.
Okay.
Presentation filed by the President of the Senate without any statement of support or whatever.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Now is Dr. Noor.
Good afternoon, Chair Galizio, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Oregon Department of Education. Mr. Chair, I provided the committee a handout that essentially we call a program brief that provides you a description of the TAC program and the services that the department provides in this area. And I'm happy to go over it with you unless there's some specific questions you would like me to address. And I also would like to point out that in your binder, the Oregon report card has information on TAG, on TAG programs. It describes the program and also provides you data on the students that have participated in the program, and you can find that on pages 76 and 77. Generally, I see you're looking at the brief, just giving you the quick summary of how the department actually supports TAG programs in the state. The TAG Education Act was passed in 1989, and it provided guidelines for districts relative to identification and serving TAG students. And the TAG law has three provisions, basically identifying students and serving them at their rate and level, identifying a process for parents to express complaints and grievances relative to the services their students receive or don't receive, and also provides opportunities for parents to get involved in their children's education and advocate for their education. Identification falls into the following categories: either intellectually gifted, and that's really the cognitive ability of the student, IQ, quite simply, academically talented students in the areas of mathematics and reading, and potential to perform at the 97th percentile, and this is defined by the district based on their benchmarks, based on their assessments of student level and performance. There are some additional categories that districts can use, such as leadership, creativity, visual, and performing arts. Currently, we have a 0.3 FTE that's dedicated to this function, and quite frankly, it's in addition to many other duties that this staff member has responsibilities for. Andrea Morgan is our talented, is our TAG specialist. She's also our social studies specialist. She's also our advanced placement and IB program specialist, and a host of other duties. The interactions that she has are primarily with the regional planning groups. These groups used to be in existence with the, when the state had funds directly aimed at promoting TAG programs and TAG services in the streets. When the funds went away, many of these groups were disbanded, but there are some remaining regional groups and organizations that we work with on a regular basis, provide information, engage in discussions relative to the needs of TAG students and how we collaborate on serving those students. We also work with professional organizations such as the Oregon Association of Talented and Gifted Students relative to professional development, curriculum, instruction, and strategies to serve TAG students. And we provide technical assistance to schools and districts on a regular basis. We get questions from teachers, curriculum directors, superintendents relative to their obligations under the TAG law, but also relative to best practices, strategies, curriculum, and content that the department can provide or suggest to develop the most effective TAG programs. We also, with our limited resources, managed to develop some resources that districts can use in their TAG programs. For example, we updated the Challenging High-End Learners material, which is a collection of 60 differentiated lessons that show how to provide appropriate differentiated instruction for TAG students grades K through 12. And also in 2006, we updated the TAG Administrator's Toolkit, which provides guidance to administrators on how to develop and implement an effective TAG program in their schools and districts. Some of our functions fall into the regulatory side. We do not review TAG programs, if you will, at the local level. We rely on the data that we collect to inform our interactions with districts relative to the number of students that they've identified and have served, the performance of TAG students, for example, and also any complaints that may come in from parents relative to the services that their students are receiving or not receiving from their school district. I discussed with you last week the continuous improvement plan. Although districts currently are not required to submit a plan to the department about their TAG program, we've incorporated some relevant questions about TAG programs and services into the continuous improvement plan that districts are required to submit to us. It's not the entire plan that districts have. They are required to have a plan for serving TAG students, but at least they will address some questions that show us how they are serving this population in their district. I believe you have some data in front of you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Senator Devlin. Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to see your interest in this particular subject, and I'm one to try to avoid editorializing, but if you look at the history of where I believe TAG programs are in this state, I think these are the children left behind. Because quite honestly, my understanding of this, and it might be rather limited, but I obviously have been approached by the same advocates, but when I was a city councilor years ago, the teacher that served on the city council with me later became a TAG teacher. By the mid-1990s, which was about the last time I had contact with her, she was spread so thin among so many schools that it was literally a joke in terms of how much time she could actually spend in each school. And I think over the passage of Measure 5, the shortages that some schools have had in meeting needs, that this is an area that if you have an analysis, and I don't know if the department has done an analysis, but there should be some clear evidence in terms of how much school expenditures have diminished in this area since the beginning of the 1990s. Because to me, I think it's at a relatively very low level now. Just programs are just trying to get, the few that are remaining are just trying to get by.
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, we have not done an analysis relative to specific expenditures by districts, but by our interactions with districts, we realize that some have very extensive, very effective programs, and others have not been able to maintain the same level of service, if you will. Much of it is driven by capacity and the need to have the right staff with the appropriate training and the skill set to truly identify talented and gifted students and then serve them. We're seeing an increase in the number of talented and gifted students in the state, and we're seeing a desire on the part of the districts to serve them, but that varies. I mean, it's a huge variance across the state.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm talking about the TAG program. Reminds me that it's kind of one of my areas of pet peeves. We spend a lot of money in the state of Oregon, as I think we should, on the program for those who are disadvantaged. Whatever reasons, whether it's because of an accident of birth or whether it's because of it doesn't make any difference. We spend, and in fact, we reimburse schools up to some percentage of their whole student body at a different rate for teaching those particular students. It's a very, and that's very laudable, and I'm not necessarily complaining about that. I probably would argue that that we have been unable to meet the needs. The mandates have exceeded the money, as such. But it strikes me that when we talk about the TAG student, we really are talking about it. The ends of the continuum have almost come full circle. To a point that we're talking about exceptional children. In this case, exceptionally talented children. And it seems to me an incredible waste of talent that we don't make the same kind of financial commitment to these people that we make to those who are less disadvantaged or less advantaged. I hear, I see, what you're doing, but our TAG programs are minuscule compared to the special ed programs that we have. And as an instructor in college, I have had numerous students flunk out of high school, and it's tough to flunk out of high school, or it was in my era when I was teaching in community colleges, solely and exclusively because they were bored out of their minds. Come to college and do very well, and in fact the honor students at the college level. We could have done so much and should be doing so much more, I think, with them. We spend a lot of time, I think, and our critics spend a lot of time talking about the fact that we aren't turning out the engineers, we're not turning out the scientists, the mathematicians, the physicists, that we need and that we probably should be. But we're missing those, I think, because they don't have the resources for that particular category of people that we may be putting at the other end. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Morton.
Well, and just to build on Representative Jensen's remarks, I think that going back to the previous discussion that we had around distance learning and using this machine as a window, that that definitely has applicability for talented and gifted students. And I know that in our rural school districts, that it's those distance learning programs that are often the window for those students to see that there is indeed light on the horizon there.
Nice metaphor. It's a portal, it's a window. I had a question for you, and I forgot what it was just after I just said that comment. It was probably a really phenomenal question that I'm still not remembering what it was. It was based on Senator Devlin's comment, but I'm really not remembering what it was. I guess it wasn't very important. I'll remember when I'm driving home, Dr. Moore.
May I make a comment, please?
Yes, please.
I think we're really thrilled that there is a great deal of interest in TAG students and building capacity for TAG programs at a state level. And we just want to stress that it's really important to build similar
capacity at the Department of Education so we can provide leadership for this program and provide the resources and supports that it takes to sustain it statewide. One of the Senate bills, Senate Bill 622, I believe, provides resources for regional programs, and I think that will begin to build capacity and signal the importance of these programs and the services to those students from the legislature and from the department. So we urge you to give us the capacity to support that work and do it well.
There's something ironic about me not being able to remember the question, and we're talking about TAG. It's kind of frightening, but it was actually, how in terms of capacity, is it really district by district in terms of using, for example, the community colleges where you have students taking classes actually at the college level? Is that really just kind of sort of district by district they sort of work with? I mean, I don't know how coordinated that is. Or
Chair Iglesio, I think it varies from place to place. Some districts have TAG coordinators that have the responsibility of working with their individual schools to identify students and develop a plan to serve them. The larger districts tend to have that. Smaller districts, rural districts in particular, sometimes rely on volunteers to identify students and serve them. This is a very staff-intensive activity because you have to train teachers. You can't assume that teachers have the skills and the abilities to identify a TAG student and then develop the appropriate plan for them. So it takes professional development to work with teachers and administrators to provide them with the skills and the ability to identify those students and be able to serve them. We see a lot of partnerships around the state. Some districts actually partner with colleges, and they provide TAG students opportunity to access college courses in high school. Some of them are dual credit courses where they can complete their high school credits and get college credit at the same time. So we see a lot of creativity and innovation in districts' attempt to serve students, but capacity and resources continue to be a barrier.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the department submit a policy option package in this area?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, the department originally had prepared a policy option package in this area, but it's not included in the governor's budget. And the department, we had to go through a process to identify our priorities based on building system-wide capacity to help support students in their educational experience. But we did initially prepare one, but it's not in the governor's budget.
Mr. Chair, follow up. May I ask about the content of the proposed policy option package that was not included?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, I believe what we requested is a full-time FTE for the department, and I'm not quite sure if we actually requested resources for grant and aid to go to the field, because that's really where the investment needs to occur. Districts need resources to hire TAG specialists, TAG coordinators, and to facilitate the professional development at the local level. But I believe for sure that we did request a full-time FTE equivalent of the department to support this effort.
Thank you.
Did you want to see that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We'll be glad to provide you with that.
Thank you. Senator Stark.
I'd like to have everybody included in that. I'd like to see that as well. Might be something that this committee, under your leadership, Mr. Chair, might want to push back on the governor's budget fund.
I agree. Glad to do that.
To make it clear, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think it would be useful if the whole committee got access to it.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Senator. Okay. Any other, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question with respect to how the TAG students have been identified. It looks like approximately 1 out of 13 students in the state would be TAG identified. 41,231,
1 out of 13. Senator Morse has an abacus right over there, so.
But the follow-up is realistic to expect 1 out of 13 students to perform at the 97th percentile. This question is not meant to lessen the importance of TAG, because I believe in it. My children went through it, and at the time they went through it was excelled, and we had great education out of our public schools and all. But those two things didn't seem to connect, and I was curious as to how we generated the 41,000 number.
Chair Galizio, Senator Morris, the 41,000 students is generated based on the 2004-2005 data collection from districts. So districts report the number of TAG students that they've identified and served. And in terms of the percentage, I can't really speak specifically to that, but it's based on the data that we collect. In terms of how students get identified to be TAG or potentially TAG students, that happens in a variety of ways. It could be a teacher that has the training, that has received training on identifying TAG students, and that teacher identifies students in their classroom and recommends that they be tested to the district office. It could be a parent request. The parent may realize that their child is gifted in a particular area, and they can make a request to the district, and the district is obligated to go through the testing and the assessment process to identify them. It could be an administrator that recognizes the talents and the skills of a particular student and also recommend them for testing. So it could happen in a variety of ways, but quite often it's really teachers that have had training on identification of TAG students based on a number of characteristics that students may exhibit in their class that recommend them for testing.
Is the criteria the same? I mean, there's an evaluation, obviously, or an assessment or a test.
Chair Galizio, that in the packet, in the document that you have before you, the brief, these are the categories that students get tested on. In terms of the criteria as to what really defines a TAG student or potentially TAG student, yes, there is a criteria that schools and districts can use to determine that. The research is very rich and extensive on TAG students and TAG programs and the process for identifying students, and I think many districts actually rely on that to determine if this student is eligible for testing.
And I just wanted to point out, and I think this is correct, these seven categories that you have here describe different ways in which a student is identified as a TAG student. Yes. The 97th percentile criterion is only one of them.
Chair Galizio, Representative Barnhart, yes, and thank you very much for making that clarification. It's not a summative kind of criteria. It's any of these categories. Yes. The student can be identified as a TAG student and be eligible for services.
Yes. Thank you. All right. Seeing no more, thank you, Dr. Moore.
Thank you very much.
Glassman, everybody. I'm going to close the public hearing at 5019, and this committee is adjourned. Thank you all.